Welcome to Long Story Long. I'm your host, Lisa Curry. Today's guest is my hilarious friend, Michael Palasak. Michael is a stand-up actor, writer. He's been on pretty much every late-night show. He's done Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, Conan, Corden, Leno, Letterman, probably Jack Parr in another realm in space. He also has a Comedy Central half hour out that is hilarious. You need to check that out right now. And he is a top five finalist on Last Comic Standing. We're both from Indiana, where all the greats are from, as I'm sure you know. I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. Here you go.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for being on today.
I love telling long stories long.
I had to name it Long Story Long because I have no control when it comes to storytelling, and I just keep going, and then it's 4 hours later and everyone's asleep.
Well, that's not true, Lisa, because you do it professionally and people light you and you get off whenever you're supposed to get off. But like, I get what you're saying.
Wouldn't it be funny if I just got off in the middle of a sentence, though? If I was like, I can't tell you the rest of the story, I got the light. And that was just like my forever.
Wait, on stage or in real life?
Yeah, on stage or in real life.
There was
I gotta go.
There was a club in Milwaukee when I first started that they had a stopwatch, and they never did it to me. But if you were like a few seconds over, they would like come up to you and be like, hey, you gotta.
What?
If you were like, I think it was like over 30 is where they were like, you gotta.
Okay, that's a little.
I know.
That's a little much.
And it might have been them just sort of like ribbing you a little bit, but they were pretty serious about it too. Yeah. And they're all like, they hired a lot of people that used to be in prison. So they were like big guys that that were running the light.
Right.
And the crowds were always very good because if you talked, they would be kind of like, let you know. And I think everyone was a little afraid of everybody that worked there. So they just like laughed out of like, we're having a good time.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's, you know what? If I actually really love that. If somebody was just, if there was a threatening force in the audience.
Mm-hmm. That's on your side.
Laughing and quiet. Yeah.
That's on the comedians. And it wasn't just one guy. It was like, probably like there were guys that parked cars and they were all there. And I'm against violence for sure. But the audience was really good.
That's, I'm a slight pro violence. Just sometimes, just to keep people in line. That's all. anyway, you grew up in Indiana, as did I.
We were neighbors.
In
the same state.
More or less. We're probably connected in some way. Where in Indiana did you grow up?
I grew up, we moved there when I was 7 and a half. It's where I had my formative years, but I was born in Cleveland and we lived in Buffalo, New York for about 3 and a half. Yeah.
Okay.
But, Wabash, Indiana is where I grew up. We moved there when I was 7 and a half because my dad started working at Shirt Shed, which was one of the only t-shirt companies to get the licensing for The Simpsons. And we weren't allowed to watch The Simpsons because my parents were kind of strict, but we all had all these extra Simpsons shirts that they just gave to us because they just had them. And so we were
That's excellent.
We could wear the shirts, but we couldn't answer any questions about the show.
So were you at school like, and people are like, eat my shorts. And you're like, sure.
Yeah. I had to confess at a very young age. I think that maybe influenced my, because I'd be like, I just had to be honest. Like, I can't watch it. I just have the shirt.
You're like, I'm just a big fan of t-shirts.
I would love to watch the show, but my parents are overbearing.
That's so funny. I know so many comics, including myself and including a friend of mine who's written for The Simpsons. So many people that were not allowed to watch it growing up because our parents thought it was like too salacious or something. It's like, I don't know where you came up with that, but okay.
I started watching it now. I'm in season 8 and I love it. And there are some episodes, especially in the beginning, where it's like, if I had a second grader, I'd be like, well, this is, and my dad would just be like, you won't get the jokes. And he was right. Like, you shouldn't, like really young, they're not going to get it, but I don't think it's going to ruin the kid. But I think at that time, there were a couple of networks, Fox was a new network. And I think people just didn't know. Like, it wasn't the Flintstones, but it was animated. And he said hell. I think that was the big reason. A lot of people.
Oh, okay.
Like, you couldn't wear the hell t-shirt to school. We didn't own it. But, like, you had to, like, tape over the two L's. If you had a t-shirt with Bart saying, what the hell? You couldn't wear that.
Could you make the tape in a shape of an L?
That's the kid that's going to be a comedian if he does that. Yeah. You got tape over it. You should start going to open mics now because that's... My roommate in college did something like that where we went to a school where, like, they were kind of strict, more strict about drinking than like, they didn't care about hours where different genders were in your dorms or whatever, but they cared about drinking a lot, and he got in trouble for drinking, and he had to write like a essay about the consequences of drinking. So he's wrote about the positive consequences of drinking, because consequences. So he's like, airplane pilots don't get bored. Like,
that's hilarious. Yeah. When you were a kid, did you know you wanted to get into comedy, or what did you think you were going to do?
Yeah, I remember when we moved to Indiana, I don't know if that's why, but that was like, I think being a new kid makes you sort of like, I don't know, you have to sort of redefine yourself at a young age. Like at age 7, all of a sudden I was with new friends, and this is before the internet or any way to stay in touch with anybody. So it's just like new people. And I remember in second grade at my new school, someone said that one of my friends said something really funny, and a teacher said that, "You're going to be a comedian," to that guy. And in my head, I didn't tell anybody, but I was like, no, that's what I want to do. And I think that was...
I love that.
Yeah. And my dad is an accountant. My mom's a teacher, but they were always very supportive. Like every night at the dinner table, my dad would ask if anybody had jokes, and I would...
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah. And I would get a joke book eventually. I got joke books. And so I would just do all the jokes. You know how kids are. They just do them.
Yeah.
To the point where they'd be like, all right, we're going to eat now. Like, I started getting the light at a very young age. Like,
wait, really quick. Whatever happened to that kid that your teacher said was going to be a comedian? Is he opening for you now, or?
No, he's not. he was a good guy.
I'm like, oh, it sounds tragic. So,
I mean, yeah. We kind of lost touch in high school a little bit, but growing up, we played sports and had a lot of fun, and he was one of my good friends.
Do you think you went into comedy because, like, as a spiteful thing or like a competitive thing? Like, oh, you think he's funny? Wait till you see what I can do.
Well, I don't think it was against him, because everyone liked it. I liked him. It wasn't like there's been people in my life where like he's really funny. I am like more competitive about that. I wasn't competitive against him. I just wanted. That just clarified the goal for me of like I had seen a ventriloquist on TV, but that's the only thing I had really seen of stand up. And that's what it clarified to me, like, oh, that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And it was like, I loved him as a friend. Like I liked him, but it wasn't like I was ever competing with him. I don't think he ever knew that it could be done. I mean, we were all living in this rural town. So there was no, there were some like musicians that would come through, and there's more now. Like I go back and do shows and stuff, but that wasn't in our world. Like, I think a big thing for me was also leaving that town. But in the meantime, being there sort of allowed me to sort of find out what I want to do. And also, I think being like a new kid, you get kind of, there's like a loneliness attached to it. And so I'd watch sitcoms, and I think I knew it was fake, but I was like, oh, they're all friends. So I think I was like, I want to act in sitcoms because then you have friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
You start writing jokes in a joke notebook. This is awesome. I love it. Did you perform at all when you were a kid? Did you like perform for an audience, or was it just your parents at the dinner table?
Yeah, no, just my parents at the dinner table. I remember my dad would always say that being a comedian was the hardest job. So I was like, oh, that's the job that I want to do. Because he's like, you have to get them on your side. Like, you have to get them listening. Like you have to get them laughing or whatever. And so I think he always had a respect for it that even though he didn't do anything like that. But I didn't do any performing stand up or anything like that, but I did plays like as a little kid, and then I didn't do anything until college. Like I stopped at fifth grade, and then there was a big gap until college, and college is when I started doing everything again.
That's cool. Wait, so you, why the gap? Did you think that you had to do something more serious, or?
I blame my teachers. No.
Oh.
I mean, not really. I'm responsible for my life. But, like, I remember we had a creative writing classes in my school in, like, second and third and fourth grade. And I loved those. Those were, like, my favorite part of school. And then when I didn't have them anymore, I just stopped. Like, I knew I wanted to write. But I was like a 30-year-old TV writer as a third grader. I was like, I should write right now. I really got to write, but I got to go do this thing. I'm going to go play games. And there was
smoking cigarettes. Yeah. Just like eating candy and calling it your writer's room.
I remember like I wrote out a story. You're just supposed to make stories out of spelling words. And mine just went super long it was about elves, and there was one in my town, and it was around Christmas time, and I saved them or something. And like, I wrote it, and then I wanted to change it, and I didn't know how to use the computer, so I just had to rewrite it by hand.
Oh my goodness.
And that was the last time I wrote after that, from fourth grade to college. Like, I was like, I just stopped. So I was like, because no one...
like, this is too, like, too long.
No one assigned it. I think if someone would have assigned it, I would have loved to do it, but I just... And then my brother, I had an older brother, and he played sports, so I started playing sports. I mean, I was all the time, but that's when it like gets busier in middle school and high school. And I went to a small school, so you didn't really, there were tryouts, but it was like, you could pretty much do whatever you, play whatever you wanted. And then, and so that was like the big gap. There wasn't time, I didn't make time for it. But I, looking back, I think, you know, I'm very happy for my life and everything I got to do. But I like writing and performing, and I took a little break. I took an 8-year
hiatus. That's awesome. So when you started doing, wait, really quick. So you go to college. Did you move out to LA right away after that? Like you're going to do
after college?
Uh-huh.
No. So this is the other big part. So when I was a junior in high school, my dad, his job just didn't have it. I don't know what the exact term was. But he had to get a new job. So he started working in Oak Lawn, or Joliet, Illinois, and staying with my grandma in Oak Lawn when I was in high school. And then when I finished high school, I had a younger brother. My mom didn't want him driving back and forth anymore, didn't want to be separated in that way. Like, they weren't separated. They were just living apart during the week. And so they just, she kind of convinced him, my younger brother convinced him to move to Chicago. And everyone was pretty sad, but I think... that's when I started doing open mics and stuff, was in Chicago, like the suburbs of Chicago during the summers when I was in college. So that's when I started doing stand-up. And then I started, I was a Chicago comedian for about, I don't know, a long time. And I moved out to LA about 10 years ago.
And when you finally made the move to LA and you were like, this is it, I'm diving in. I feel like your parents were probably excited because they got to see you when you were a kid doing it.
Oh my gosh. So I think that was a big help for me, was my parents were always like, when I was in college, they did what parents do. Like, my mom would be like, he can do what he wants, it's fine. My dad would be like, no, he needs to have major in something. That's a job. Like, I told my dad I was going to be an English major, and he was like, no. And so I Googled like successful English majors. And I've never been able to find this list since. I think somehow it was just there, and I emailed it to my dad, and it listed like Supreme Court justices, and I think Chevy Chase, who my dad liked, who I also like, was an English major. And then I think the biggest one was Marty Schottenheimer, who was the head coach of the Browns in the 80s when they were good, the Cleveland football team, the Browns. And I think also my mom had a lot to do, and he just like left me alone. I just got to do that, and... I still had to take all the math classes because he wanted me to be able to do something else if I wanted to. But then when I finished college, my mom was like, well, you got to get a job and support yourself and just do this when you can. And my dad was like, no, he did this to do this. So I just lived at home with my parents for like 3 or 4 years. I mean, longer, but I was on the road after about 3 or 4 years. And then I just did stand up and drove their car and ate their food. And
sounds wonderful. Do you think they would take me in now, or...
I mean, I think it was partially because I was related to them, but okay. I can make a call.
I'm just looking for somebody to adopt me. That's what this podcast is about.
They live about 30 miles outside of Chicago. It was a great life. Like, I think it made me really appreciate stage time a lot because I was able to do it. I was able to drive and do shows. And also, I didn't drink because I couldn't lose my license because I had to drive into the city. So I was very productive. I was just so grateful for that opportunity. And then, like, you don't realize how long it takes, but it took a while. And then I was able to start doing colleges and all that stuff.
That's awesome. What was your first gig where you thought, like, oh, this is for sure going to be my career? Like, this is, because I feel like, I mean, I don't know, maybe you didn't have any doubts, but I do feel like so many of us get started and we're like, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. But there's always like this little voice in the back of your head that's like, okay, but are you? I mean, because let's see what happens.
Am I talking too fast? I listened to myself on a podcast recently and I was like, you got to slow down. Okay.
You're fine.
That's a good question. I think looking back at it generally, I can be like, I guess there's one. Okay, there's a couple. So I remember driving back from college before I was graduate, like junior year or something. And I found this CD. Those are compact discs for the serious people. that had an interview with Jerry Seinfeld on it from like laugh.com, but it was like an interview from the 80s that they just put on the CD. And the way he talked about stand-up to this interviewer was first kind of like a little detached and like, why are you asking me questions? Which was funny to me at the time. But also like he just sort of outlined, you just do shows and you write and then do more shows. And I think that was the first moment where I was like, oh, I can do that. Like it'll take whatever, however it takes, but I'm just going to do that. And so I had started doing stand-up before that, but that's when it was like, oh, I got to go up all the time and I got to write and that'll just be what I do. And then I think there was always like a little bit of an anxiety of like the first few years of like, am I ever going to make money? Am I also, because you're not working, I think when you get a paycheck and you work no matter what the job, there's this feeling of like, oh, I'm doing something, you know? And I feel like as a stand-up, when you don't have that, it's like, well, what am I doing? Maybe I should just get a job anyways. But I did this contest. Comedy Central used to have these contests. It was called Open Mic Fight. And it was like, okay. You submit a tape. And I literally, you could do it online, but I literally had a tape because that was the time. Like, I couldn't figure out how to do the internet thing. So I sent in a tape. And I got to do the showcase in Chicago. And and it was so funny. My mom has tons of cousins that live in Chicago. And I went to a wedding and a funeral the 2 weeks before that show. Person was old. Okay. Married people are happy. But it was like I saw so much family who hadn't seen me perform before. They're like, when's your show? I'm like, well, I'm doing this cool show at Zany's in 2 weeks. And Zany's is not a big room. There's like 140 seats. And I probably had like 20 or 30 people there. It wasn't like I tried to pack the room, but it was like literally a ton of family came. And so I like won that contest and got to go out to LA. And I think that was like the first time in Chicago that I sort of felt like I was doing, I felt like very affirmed in my choices.
Yeah, of course. Like winning something. I don't think I've ever, it's not about me. I don't think I've ever won like a comedy thing. It's always like, you're doing all right.
Well, I think like just because you started out in LA, right?
Yeah, yeah, I did, which is weird. And I don't recommend to anybody getting into comedy.
But like, I took a while to come to LA and I think in the Midwest, to move up a little, like there's no other jobs really. You just do stand up. Or at least at the time, they weren't really shooting shows there. So you kind of had to stand out in some way to feel like you're doing anything. So I think that was my thing. And then I think at that show was like a college agent was there. And that's how I got my college agent. That's when I was able to live for a while. And that was interesting because my friend Jeb Cadwell, who's a comedian, was doing a thing where he was going to do like 300 shows in 300 days or something. So he would just do all these open mics. And you know people like that. They just know all the open mics and they go to all of them regardless. And not just like one a night, just like lining them up.
It's like Rain Man, but for open mics.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And this was when Chicago wasn't as big, so you could really get up a lot. Like the city was, but the scene was smaller. So you could get up a lot and you wouldn't have to wait all the time necessarily. So whenever I wanted to go up and I need another one, I would just follow him. I started going to these like poetry open mics and music open mics. And the music open mics are really fun because you do more time. And there was one lady that ran one and she was with this college agent and she ended up inviting them to my show. And that was like that's how I lived for a while. So
that's awesome. So the college agent just came out and was like, Yeah.
You're
perfect.
Well, like they came to one show. There's a guy named Mikey O that used to do shows in Chicago. And those were probably the first shows that felt like real shows. They were like, he would pack like 300 people in this bar. And
oh, wow.
It was like it was a diversity show. And I was always like the white guy or the Irish guy.
Irish guy. Yeah. I love that they're trying to be like, no, it's diverse. This guy's Irish.
Yeah. I have a friend who's like really more Irish than me. And he's Mexican too. And he kind of like when he couldn't do it, I get to be the Irish guy because he didn't necessarily look diverse.
Also, it's hilarious to think of Irish being a diverse thing in Chicago specifically. It's like 50% Irish people and 50% Polish people.
I know. I feel like it was called something like that. But I think I just got in with those shows and those were like really big shows. And that's when the college agent, like the assistant and one of the agents came out for the first time. And then they got the agents to come to the contest. And I remember I left tickets for them at the door and they weren't on the list. And so they like almost had to pay. And he's like, I'll take it out of your commissions. And I was like, well, that's a good sign that I'll have commissions.
Yeah. Yeah. You're like, oh, okay. So you think that I'm going to make enough that you'll get a cut. Okay.
Good.
That's good. What did you think of LA when you first got out here? Did you enjoy it, or was it a hard adjustment? Because Chicago is such a fun city for comedy.
Well, I always lived in the suburbs, so I was always a little detached from all the scenes. Like I did shows, and I had friends that I started out with in the suburbs, who were very funny. But I wasn't necessarily. I never got that like living in a city experience where you could just like leave your house and go do a show. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were some shows like that. But that's what I loved about LA is like I could walk to the Improv when I moved here. I lived by the Grove, which was a cool area to walk around in.
Sure. A lot of shows there?
Not really in the Grove, but there's a lot of LA stuff, like seeing mountains and the ocean. And
yeah.
And I moved out here like because I had a manager who was getting me on tape for auditions, and he was like, it'd be good to be out here. So I came out with like a lot of stuff happening at the time, so I was very, there was nothing to be sad about or like distressed about or anything like that, so it was very fun in the beginning in LA.
That's
and it
awesome.
Was fun in the middle and then, but there were parts that got harder later, but in the beginning it was really fun.
Yeah. Did you so when did you did Letterman, which is crazy to me because it's like that was the show to be on.
Yeah.
At a point, you know, like what, at a point being like when it was on, what was, how did that come up? Was that your first late night spot?
No. So Eddie Brill used to do Zanies, who booked Letterman for a long time. And there's a comedian named Tommy Jonigan, who's very funny, who writes for TV.
Oh, Tommy is so funny.
Oh yeah. He's the best. And, I credit him a lot for his influence on my career. 'Cause we were in Chicago that first summer together. And he was so focused. Like, I remember the first time I met him, or one of the first times we were hanging out, he was like, I'm working on my 30 minutes to go on the road. And I was like, oh yeah, we all are. You know, but he did it. Like, he like spent three months in the summer there and got time and started going on the road as a feature. And then he like started, he did Montreal first and he did Letterman first. And it was like, he was the person I could be like, oh, that's, I wasn't even like, I was consciously thinking that's what you do, but it was fun to think about that because of how he got to experience it. He did lots of comedy.
It's nice to have like a little bit of a roadmap like that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not like he was years ahead of me. He was younger than me. We were the same class, I think, but he was maybe a year younger, age-wise. But so he had done Letterman and Eddie Brill would do Zanies. And I remember the booker at Zanies, Bert Haas, when he started booking me, he like saw me open for somebody at the club and was like, oh, you'd be great for this showcase. And so he put me on it and I showcased ready and he wasn't like really into it. He didn't like hate it, but he was like, you're not going to do it right away. And I think sometimes bookers have that, which I totally get. You have a list of people that are doing the show. So there's no reason to put someone ahead of anybody that's you know, new or whatever. So, I kind of just kept meeting him and showcasing for him and it never happened. And then my manager at the time said that the Tonight Show people were looking for somebody because it was right when Jay took over for Conan again. So I think they were just like trying to get new people in.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And I was just, I remember I worked on so many tapes for Eddie that hadn't gotten picked and I was driving down to Zany's to do like their Monday showcase for fun. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to have my camera in the back of my car and up tripod. And I went there. And when I started in Chicago, Zany's didn't have an open mic or a showcase or anything. You just had to like know someone working there and try to get a guest spot, which is fine, but that's just the way it was. But now they had like a showcase and people would bring their friends. So it was like such a hot crowd. Like, I don't know if you ever saw a club like that where sometimes the open mic was better than the shows because the crowd was so used to people just like not being great, like sort of starting out that they were like, If you went up there with material that was good, they were like falling in love with you because the people that were up before you are like a year in and they're kind of like just working it out. So it was like that kind of enthusiastic, supportive crowd. And I remember my friends, Mary Mack and Tim Harmson were in town and they were in the back and just set up my camera on this chair. And I was like, it wasn't sturdy, but I was like, it'll work. And I went up there and it was like a really good tape. And I sent it to my manager and they were like, we like all of it. And then I flew out to LA for something else. And they came to see a show and they're like, just drop the last joke. It might be like months before you get to do the show, but we like this set. So just keep working on it. And then before I left LA, like 2 days later, they're like, you're going to do it July 8th. And that was the Tonight Show with Jay. So I was like, oh, okay. I think they asked if I was available. And I was like, yeah.
That's so exciting.
Who says they're not available?
Who are these people?
Yeah. Who's like, oh, I booked the whatever.
I have a lunch. You know, I'm gonna get a massage that day. I'm so sorry. Can you fit me in some other time?
I just
can I rain check? Like, that's so awesome to also be able to do the Tonight Show for your first one because it's so iconic.
Oh, yeah. And Jay was super nice. He, like, gave me a watch and he, like, came up to me and introduced himself to me. Yeah, he gave me, I have a watch. This is the Tonight Show with Jay Leno. And yeah.
That's so fun.
And he came up to me during rehearsals and was like, he introduced himself to me as if I, like, you're wearing denim. We all know. He's like, I'm Jay.
Yeah.
And he like told me I could start over if I wanted to. Like, don't worry if it's going like start over. And then he told the crowd to like, only two late show people have ever done that where they like go out to the crowd and they're like, laugh a lot at this guy because this is not the normal environment for this. And Jay did that. And so did James Corden, where they like go out and they go out of their way to be like, make sure this is a good experience. Cause everyone in the crowd loves the host. And so when you have someone do that, it just makes all the difference in the world. And I think Letterman had people do it for him, but when the host did it, it was cool. So that was a really good experience. And the guests were Steve Carell and Jane Lynch, who was like, those are like, I mean, if I had to imagine it, it would be like, well, those are the people that I would want to be the guests. And they both stayed. So like, there's like a picture of me kind of like looking awkwardly in like a suit that doesn't look good at Steve Carell, who had like flown in on a private jet to promote the Minions movie that
probably,
came out.
Probably, yeah.
And Jane Lynch, who's taller than me.
Jane Lynch was dropped in through a helicopter.
Yeah. And she's like taller than me and being more nice to me than I am, because I just don't know what to say. I'm just like, oh yeah, I grew up here in Indiana. I don't know. Like, and so it was such a cool experience. And then 6 months later, I don't know if it was because of the Tonight Show, but I was going to do the Tonight Show again because they were so nice and they were like, we want you on again. And my manager was like, we'll see if you can do Dave first. So I told them I had a new set and I want to do their show before I do the Tonight Show. And then they just put me on in like January or whatever. So
that's so awesome.
Yeah.
Did you get to hang out with David Letterman?
No, he came over. He came over after my set and he asked where I was from because he knew I was, or where I went to college.
Oh, yeah.
He knew I was from Indiana. Yeah. And I said Xavier.
All the greats are.
Yeah, exactly. So he wasn't as interested once I said I didn't go to Ball State, but he was super nice. And,
yeah. He's like, never mind. Get out of here.
Cincinnati. Well, he said Cincinnati. Like, he was fine. Letterman's was really cool because it was so iconic. Like you said, it was, and I was so much more relaxed because it was my second one and it was New York and
yeah.
It just seemed really fun. And like, no one really, Eddie was really cool because once you got it, he was just like, yeah, just do that. And he wasn't like picking apart or anything, which I do like
that
too.
That's really nice.
When people like do this, but Eddie was just like, yeah, that's good. Just do that. Whereas like the Tonight, all the other people are kind of like, just do this. And they're all like more worried than I am. I'm like, well, I'm going to be okay.
Yeah, I've always found that interesting because it's like, I understand tweaking some things, but I've had some friends that have gone through, you know, 50 rounds of notes or whatever for a 5 minute set. And it seems like at a point you might get away from it. It might be so much feedback that you come away from the stand-up's actual personality and their material.
Definitely. And I feel like the good people that do that, that pick apart, are good at seeing that and then being like, oh yeah, we're not gonna have you yet. Like, which sucks because it's like you wrote yourself out of the show. But the people that give a lot of notes, I think, are really good when they do that. And then they're like, oh, this is it. And you sort of have time to sort of take it all in or not. They're just going to let you have the show. But it is, I think Eddie was a comic and he just knows what it's like when, from that standpoint. And my stuff's all clean. Like, there wasn't any like conflict or clean. And so,
yeah, it's not like he's like, you've got to cut this anal sex bit.
Yeah. I left all those.
We know it's like your big famous closer.
And then, so right after I did Letterman, I moved out to LA like 2 weeks later. Like, that was like, not because of that. It just happened to work out time-wise. So that was really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I've also heard, I mean, like, I don't know. Like, it seems like it'd be a lot of fun to do something like, you know, I'm sure we both have friends that have done the Tonight Show multiple times. But I'm like, how cool to also be able to do a bunch of different shows and experience that. Like, I've heard Corden is one of the most fun ones to do.
Yeah. So that studio is really cool and intimate. And James is the other one that, like, before your set, he's like, hey, everybody, there's a comedian that is used to performing for people who are drinking. So really let loose, like, enjoy it. And
so whatever you have in your purse, eat it now, drink it now.
he was on par with Leno being like, so, and like, he came to my dressing room beforehand and said hi. And, yeah, those, they make it all the more fun. And I was talking to someone about how, like, you can do a podcast like this or put up a YouTube video and like and get like tons of views. That's maybe more than some of those shows, but I think those shows will always have a place for at least a while in America's culture, just because of how many people still, you know, watch TV the way I watch TV. And also as a comedian, they're super fun. So I hope they stay around just for that.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So you also, I mean, you know, you've been diligently writing since you were a toddler. And I got to work with you on your pilot. Where, how did you kind of cross over into like, creating a pilot and doing things, doing other projects outside of stand-up?
Yeah. So, Chris Burns, who said hi, by the way, we just talked. He was my manager. And, I was visiting New York during like the winter and we were having breakfast or something. And he was talking about how cold it is. And I said that, well, that's good because all the germs are dead when it's cold. And he was like, you should do a show where you think of something negative and or something negative, then you try to find the positives of it. So that was like the first time I ever really considered doing a show that was like I'd auditioned for acting stuff, but like sort of like your own sort of sketch clip, whatever. And so I just sort of put that together. And I, at the time, it just seemed the best way to sort of expand your followers in a super fun way to be creative and be funny. Like where you're doing different stuff all the time. Like with stand-up, you know, like you do a joke and you can do it for your whole life if you want to. And so having those type of things like shows or pilots really lets you create new stuff because you have to. And so with that, I wrote like the show idea, and then we pitched it and brought on Evan, the producer. And I remember when we were writing that show, there was a point where it was like we had an interview with like a psychologist or something. And I was literally like writing questions like a half hour before we did. I was like, I would never do this as a comedian. Like think of putting something on tape that I'm writing now. And it was so fun to like be able to do that.
Yeah.
Cause those shows are so protected by the format that you can, that's like, well, this is what the show is. You just have to write stuff like that. And,
yeah. And I think also in those shows, I mean, you, for like a longer show like that, you're shooting so much and then with the ability to trim it down later. So it's like, if you throw some stuff in there and it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
Well, also I grew up, when I started doing stand-up, Colbert Report would be on Comedy Central when I came home from shows. So I would just watch that show. And Daily Show is great too, but I really loved Stephen Colbert's character on that show. Like, I just loved it. And I thought whenever I was, like, I would write submissions for that show, like, it was so fun to write because that point of view was so clear. So I think when it came to my show, I tried to do something similar to that, where it could be, like, really carried by the point of view of the host. Because if you can make people laugh like that, you can just always keep doing shows because you don't, it's not about what's going on in the world. You can just feed it to whatever's going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
What are you, have you had anything in your career that you were like really surprised by? Like, oh fuck, I can't believe this happened, or I can't believe I went in this direction.
Well, I became a dad. That was a huge surprise.
That's a really surprising career
move. It was a really surprising career move. I'm mostly
a dad. Is
it up
to your social media at all? Or
I don't.
Was this like you became a dad for TikTok? Or
people would say that as a joke. They'd be like, "Are you doing this for your job?" And I was like, "It's so much work. I feel like that's. I tried to do it on stage. I'd be like, that's like asking a coal miner, like, are you in it for the diamonds? Because it's not going to pan out for a long time.
No, I have heard some male comedians say to one another, at a certain point, you got to get married for the material. This is so psychotic.
No.
What's wrong with everyone?
Well, that's a separate tangent for sure. I remember when I started out doing comedy, I was like out of college, in college. And so I had a lot of jokes about that. And I started to worry, like, what will I write about next? And I realized you just write about whatever you're writing about and it's just there. And before I met my son's mom, like I was talking more about like travel hotel type stuff, but I still had stories and I can still do them. So it's not like you don't need a main character in your life to beat up on stage to be a comedian. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. There's also like some, not to get too far off base, but there's also some comics. I'm thinking of one guy in particular. This guy is mediocre at best, looks wise. And his wife looks like a model.
Yeah.
But he's, all of his jokes are like, my fucking bitch wife, can you believe she makes me flush the toilet? You know, it's like, sir, come on.
Yeah, you're lucky to be in on the field, let alone in the game.
Like, really, what are you talking about? You
should be sidelines of this. Yeah. I always feel like when it comes to, and this is a Seinfeld thing too, I think, that he mentioned, he doesn't talk about people in his life because he could never imagine making up stuff. But I always feel like when it came to people in my life, I had to just say the things that actually I wouldn't make up stuff. Mm-hmm. Because people can tell when you make up stuff. And if you're making fun of someone that's not there and you're making it up, at least for me, because mm-hmm. I feel people don't laugh as much because they get, but if it's real and it's making fun of someone else, I think people can see it in your eyes and they're like,
yeah, there's like a different emotion that hits. It's like, it's kind of like when, I mean, the only thing I can think of that's comparable is like, you know how animals can sense fear.
Mm-hmm.
I think similarly, well, one, the crowd knows when you're fucking scared or nervous
yeah.
because we're animals. But I think that they also know when something's inauthentic, even yep. if they're like, I think even if they don't consciously clock it, like, oh, this feels like a lie. I think that they're thinking, I don't love this.
Yep. 100%.
Fun about it.
I noticed that very early on as a comedian. And that can be for big things. It's like, oh, I'm going to like throw this out there. But even like little parts of bigger jokes don't work. Like they don't feel right. Like mm-hmm. there's a bigger part that's going to laugh later, which is great. But there's a part that doesn't work right. And then I look back at it and it's like, oh, because I just sort of glossed over this with a term or a phrase that's not accurate to what I feel really happened.
Mm-hmm.
And people are always about cutting words, which I think is important. But for me, I think it helps to add the words to say the thing in a way that's true to me and then go back and be like, what can I get rid of? Because people can tell.
Yeah.
Like saying something. That's also the part when I started out in Chicago, I took a lot of like improv classes, and Improv Olympic was very much like the finding what's in you that's funny, basically. And I think I always, that became sort of like one of my things to draw from was like, how do you more honestly portray yourself rather than how do I be funny? Like, how do you more honestly communicate this thought as a better way to funny than like, how can I be funny?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting concept. Like, I think like I did Second City out here in Los Angeles
yeah.
and their big thing was like, just, you know, play the truth of it and don't try to be funny. And I think when I first started, I was like, what the fuck do you mean
yeah.
don't try to be funny? But there is so much humor in just being honest,
yeah.
which sounds silly, but people just aren't honest generally, and
yeah.
not in a bad way. Not like, I'm not saying like they're liars and they're
no.
mean people. It's just, you know, people just kind of agree with other people automatically in mm-hmm. conversation to keep things moving.
Or, yeah, they just agree. All you know. Yep, I agree.
Thank you. The other day I was in the green room with somebody, and I can't remember what we were talking about. Should I wish I could? But this comic was like, don't you feel like X, Y, and Z thing? And I initially go, yeah. And then I stop myself and I go, actually, no.
Yeah.
I said, I'm sorry. I'm trying to not just reflexively agree with things. And I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't. And it was like some kind of, you know, he was talking about like a feeling you get when you do some kind of gig or something.
Yeah, it wasn't like the death penalty or something.
Yeah, I wasn't like, hold on a second. No, I don't think people should be murdered in the streets. Where do you think they should be?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And I think now looking back, I think you can be funny and have the idea of like, I'm trying to be funny. But I think when you're teaching a class on people that haven't ever done it before, the easiest way for people to be funny, especially in the beginning, is just to sort of let go of all the pretense and just sort of, like you said, find the truth
mm-hmm.
of the moment. Because I think lying is also funny when you can tell that they're lying. So.
I think for me, it's infuriating when I can tell somebody's lying.
Well, only on stage. Like, yeah, in real life. Yeah, I would be upset. But like as a joke or a sketch or whatever, like when someone is saying something that's not true and the audience knows that it's not true, that's
yeah.
funny to me.
Yeah.
Sometimes. I don't know.
Is there anything from your career where you, that like has taken an unexpected turn, like something that you didn't think was very significant or you didn't think was a big deal that turned into something bigger?
Yeah. So I got to do Last Comic Standing the first year they went to like just 100 people or whatever. This is your Rodman.
I think you've done literally every comedy-based TV show.
Yeah, I don't mean to keep dropping.
No, it's great.
But there's a good.
I'm very impressed.
There's a good path. So I did it, and Russell Peters, like, I was doing older jokes because that's just what I wanted to do in the first round. And Russell Peters, like, it doesn't sound like you. And I was in my head, I was like, yeah, because I wrote these however many years ago. I'm not that person. Mm-hmm. And
were they the jokes you wrote at the dinner table when you were like, five?
Yeah, I was. Yeah. It was in toddler language. No, they were like just older jokes. And so, like, after that, I was like, oh, I'm going to do that. I'm going to be better about even performing old stuff to try to say them as I talk now. Mm-hmm. And so that all happened. I didn't get on, move on. I didn't get used in the show, but I got invited to the wrap party, and that's where that story mm-hmm. starts. And I was like, I live in LA. If I get invited to a party, I can go. I go because I'm usually on the road, so I go. And I was there, and the producer was there, and she was very nice, and she was like very apologetic that they didn't use my stuff even to like show me getting cut. And I was like, that's fine. I'm fine. I've been on all mm-hmm. the shows. I didn't say that.
Yeah, you're like, this is literally the last one on my list, and it's like not even that important because I've done all the rest. Yeah. So thanks so much.
So she was like, don't worry, we'll use you next year. I was like, that's fine. And when people tell me stuff, I believe them. Because I know some people are like, oh, it's LA. People say whatever they want to say.
I do too. And it can be good sometimes. And then sometimes I'm like, oh, am I a huge dum-dum?
Sometimes I've texted people before where I was like, can I do this thing? Because you said you would want to do this thing with me someday. And I saw and they're like, no. I'm like, oh, okay, sorry. You said that you would always love to do this.
Lying.
And you don't want to do that? I shouldn't have read into the words that you said that are those things.
That are directly that. Okay.
So I have to check myself because I'm kind of gullible or naive in the sense that like people just say stuff. Like I remember there's a comic that moved out to LA and he's like, we'll get a burger. And so like I texted him and he just didn't respond. And I was like, oh, that's just something he says to people.
And you're like, no, I thought you meant like a literal burger.
I like cheeseburgers and we both live in the same town. How many times do I have to text you to follow? So we never happened. And he's a nice guy. Well, I'm sure it'd be. Anyways, so this lady said, we'll use it next year. And I was like, perfect. That's great. I'm doing it the next year. So I do the audition again, which I didn't even know I'd have to do because she already told me I was doing it. And it was like a Wednesday night at the Improv, late show Wednesday. And on Melrose, and I was doing new stuff because I was like, I'm already on the show. I want to show them new stuff. And it did not go well at all. And then I didn't hear back. I heard people being flown to New York and LA, and I was like, well, I'm doing the show. She told me I'm doing the show. So all this goes by. I never hear anything. And then, like, I think I'm in Cleveland in March. And this is also the part that I thought was so, you know, Dave Landau is a very funny comedian. Who should not be featuring in front of me, but he was a Sunday and he hadn't worked that club before and he was featuring and I was headlining the Sunday show. I was featuring all week and then headlining mm-hmm. Sunday show. And we were talking before the show because he did Last Comic the year before and I was like, that was so great. And he was like, he was kind of upset about the process. And I was like, are they doing it again? He's like, yeah, I think they're starting it next week or whatever. And I was like, oh, that's cool. So he goes up before me, just destroys. It's really hard to follow, but I'm fine with it. I'm at the point in my career mm-hmm. where I can be fine with that. But I go home and I email the only email I have of the producer's assistant. And I was like, hey, I know you said I could do the show and I haven't heard anything. So I'm just wondering when you need me or whatever I said. And here's a Conan clip or whatever. And they're like, oh yeah, we had someone fall out next week. So you can come do it. And so I like literally like walked on the show. I was like, I flew back and forth from Chicago cause I was doing Zanies that weekend. And then they shot it in 2 weeks and I got to go on like an 80 city tour. And it's just all because Dave Landau told me that they were doing the show and I think he didn't want to do it.
Whoa, that's yeah. crazy.
So I made like all the money. Like I didn't, right before I found out I was doing the show, my dad drove me to the airport and he was like, I don't know what you're going to do because the colleges had slowed down. And like I was in LA for about 5 years at that point. And like, I still had a manager, but my agent dropped me. It was like all these different things that happened. He's just like, uh-huh. maybe you need to find someone else. And then, Dave Landau told me
that. Let's take a look at that English degree.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what you could do with that.
And then I remember my dad, I told him I was doing Last Comic Standing and he was going to come see me at Zany's that week with his like people he worked with. And he's uh-huh. like, I don't think you should do that show because they don't really treat comedians that well. Because in the past they've been a little critical. And I was like, whenever my dad's told me something or someone who I like respect and I don't want to do it, that's when I know I should definitely do it because that's when you know you want to do something, when someone you respect or like value you, like they're pretty trustworthy, tells you to do something and you still don't think you should do it. I think that's a good sign you should do the thing you want to do because it always works out.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think and also like, you know, parental worries are I think you have to take them kind of lightly.
That's
because,
very true.
Because also, like, our parents just want us to be happy and safe and make money. And, well, your parents probably do. I think mine want me to be miserable. I'm kidding. And I think that they're just grasping at straws sometimes. Like, you know, anytime something goes wrong for me, if I, like, don't book something or something falls through, my dad, like, just out of frustration is like, well, you can be an electrician. I can help you get in the union. And I'm like, okay, relax. I'm not going to be an electrician. Yeah. I just lost one gig. Hang on, you know?
Yeah. I think, like, my dad gave up on that part when I was in college. Like, he would say that when I was in college. Because I remember the first time I was working at a club, the owner used to have a book that he had. I turned the light on and off because I didn't know what was better.
Oh,
I thought it was a weird glare. I don't know if going to see that, so it's not good. But now, like, I was using the light outside.
Picture a weird light.
It's just like this side of my face. But my dad, I remember the club by my parents' house, the owner would bring his calendar and you could get hosting work, which is like the first time you could work at the club and get paid. It was like $40 a show, which is good. It's still good for hosting. And he told me I could do it. And then I would go up to him on Thursday after the open mic. And he'd be like, oh, I don't have my book with me. And I remember my dad knew that I was going to get a week. And he was like waking up for work and I was going to bed because like he would just wake up really early for work. Or he saw me at some point. I was waking up when he was going to work. And he's like, oh, did you get the week? And I was like so frustrated. I kind of like snapped at him. And he's like, it's okay. You know, it'll whenever. He was just really nice about it. And I was like, oh, I think.
Oh, that's really sweet.
Yeah, I think if he's so chill about it, I should probably be a little more chill. So I think I'm very grateful for that experience of them having that. But also he's not an electrician, so I don't think he can get me in the union. So
yeah, my dad isn't either. I think he just thinks that that would be a good labor job for a woman. he tried to talk me into ironworking several times, and I was like, no, because he's an iron worker, and he's like, you could cut it.
Yeah,
you're strong, and I'm like, that's not the issue, though. What?
I was in the rubber workers union for a day.
What?
Yep.
Wait, for a day?
So,
how do you join for a day?
Yeah, so I worked at GenCor when I was in high school. Like, after I graduated, I turned 18, and you can work at a factory. And you have to wait 30 days to join a union. So I turned 18 on June 26th, and then I worked for a month. And then, well, I don't think I started working there until July. So I worked for a month. And then once you join the union, they can bump you. Like, I was on first shift, and they can bump you. So I was going to get bumped to third or second shift. And I was playing in an American Legion Baseball League tournament. And I was like, oh, I gotta go to that. So I can't work nights. And so they were like, well, just call in sick or whatever. So I called in sick a couple times. And then my dad was like, you should probably just go to college and stop working there. So I just quit. But I was in the union for a day. I was honorably discharged from the steel rubber workers union. I used to manufacture the rear right-hand insulation on the 2001 Ford Explorers. That was my job.
Oh, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, so if anybody had that messed up, that was me. I was not very good at my job.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it sounds, if you weren't even in the union for the almost the entire time you did that. So
yeah.
Ooh, yeah. Pretty dicey. Yeah, if your car's falling apart, contact Michael.
So I've done hard labor and it's not fun. I don't recommend
it. It's not fun at all. I've done it as well. And it's I never want to do that again.
Yeah, I think like now as a comedian, like there's like I when I during the pandemic, especially when I couldn't really work and I'd walk past like these construction guys, I'm like, that'd be cool. That'd be cool to be able to work right now. But I know it's not. I know it's not cool.
Yeah.
They're not.
And God bless them. But I'm like, I'm happy for the experience because I'm like, well, it adds some kind of flavor to my life.
I'm very grateful for the experience and the people were great. I was telling a friend this. I was like, it's funny because my parents like were very like, you can go to college and we'll help you out, but you need to work. Like I was working 60 hours a week. Like I was making pretty good money back then. And they were very encouraging me going to work and working a lot. But I was telling my friend from high school, I was like, the people working at this factory are great, but they're the people I wasn't allowed to hang out with in high school. Like, these are the people that I wasn't allowed to go to parties
with. You're like, they're watching The Simpsons at work.
I know. Don't have a cow. Like, now I know all the stuff, and I'm getting paid, so it's fine.
Yeah.
I remember I had to take a drug test, and I'd shaved my head for a baseball tournament, and so they had to, like, take hair from other parts of my body. It was just like, where am I going to work? That they're, like, taking my hair. My body.
They take a bunch of it and then they just call, they call you into the office the next day and just present you with like a weird voodoo doll. And you're like, wait, I thought you were taking this in for a drug test. And they're like, no, this is just, no, not at all.
This is just you. This is a little you.
Welcome to the company. Terrifying. I have one last question for you. If your like 8-year-old self could meet you now, what do you think he would think?
Oh, I think he'd think I'm much cooler than I think I am now, because I'm a comedian. And I know that sounds like not, you're supposed to be upset about your life or whatever, but I think like when I was 8, I wanted to do this. And then, you know, I took a little, what's it called? I took a little break.
Sabbatical
for 8 years.
Pursue other interests. From 8 years old to 16.
To get my baseball swing down or whatever and take calculus. And I'm back at it, you know? And like, it just goes to show you, you can stop doing something for 8 years and get back to it as long as you're a kid.
You do it. Like, yeah, you and Rodney Dangerfield both quit comedy and then came back later. So
I think he'd be really excited that I get to live this life, because I never thought I would too. I think going to college and not being good enough to play sports made me like find other things I wanted to do, and this was it. And I'm very grateful for that lack of skill that I inherited from my parents. I blame them.
That's awesome. I mean, they seem like excellent parents.
Yeah, they're great. They're fantastic.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
It was my honor. I see them and I'm like honored to be a part of your world.
You're like, when the fuck am I going to be?
No, I'm just grateful to be in the Lisa Curry universe. That's.
Oh, good. Thanks. it's always fun talking to you. You know, maybe one day I will do some of the 15 shows that you were on, and and I can get some advice from you.
I would love to help out in any way that I can. Anyway.
Thank you. All right. Well, I will talk to you soon.
Thanks, Lisa.
All right. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. Once again, that was Michael Palasak. You can find him on Twitter and Instagram at Michael Palasak. It's spelled P-A-L-A-S-C-A-K. And I am Lisa Curry. You can find me on Twitter at Lisa_Curry and on Instagram at Olympian Lisa Curry. Exciting news, everyone. If you are enjoying the show, you can enjoy it a little bit sooner if you subscribe to SiriusXM. This show has relaunched and will be airing every Thursday at noon and 8 p.m. on SiriusXM's She's So Funny channel. So when you're hearing it here on, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you're listening, you're hearing it a week or two late. So if you want to get it sooner, go ahead and sign up for SiriusXM and check it out every Thursday. Otherwise, you know the deal. Like, subscribe, write your congressman, hire a skywriter, all those things. And see you next week. Thanks. Bye.